Hello and welcome to Blogging Theology. And this evening I have a very special guest, a man who has sent shockwaves, I think, through many circles in the West, both for not so good reasons in the past and now for very good reasons in recent years. And Joram, you are most welcome on Blogging Theology.
Well, thank you very much. And it's a great honor for me to be here.
Well, just to give viewers a brief summary of your biography, Joram van Cleveren is a Dutch person, also known as the Crown Prince of Wilders, meaning Geert Wilders, the leader or the political leader of the party in Holland, Party for Freedom, where you became a member of parliament yourself in the Dutch parliament, and you submitted a number of bills in the parliament related to Islam, such as those calling for the closure of mosques, for removing the Quran from parliament itself, where there was a copy, and for banning Islam from the Netherlands as much as possible, basically to remove Islam and presumably Muslims from the Netherlands. And in order to reinforce these thoughts and opinions that you had as a Christian, which you were then, you began to write a book critical of Islam. And during the process of writing, I understand, you found an increasing number of matters that challenged your views on Islam. And this is the book you ultimately wrote, called Apostate. We'll come back to that. And this gives your personal and theological journey that you undertook away from a position of frank hostility towards Islam, towards someone who actually embraced Islam several years ago. So a most extraordinary story. So that's why many people will be very interested to see what you have to say about your life. And perhaps a couple of questions which occurred to me would be of great interest. Could you perhaps just tell us initially a bit about your Christian background and beliefs growing up in the Netherlands?
Yeah, of course. Well, I was brought up in a relatively strict Protestant denomination, the Reformed Church of the Netherlands. Right. And well, it was a normal family: father, mother, I have an elder, older brother, sister, younger brother, and we had a cat. we went to church on Sundays. Of course, we all got Christian names. My father read from the Bible before dinner. After dinner, we prayed. So we did all the things that normal Christian, practicing Christians do, because there's, of course, a difference between cultural Christians and practicing Christians. But also in the family, my grandfather was, so to say, an assistant of the ministers in church. Been that for a very long time. So it was in our family, the tradition, the religious tradition was pretty strong. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I was brought up, in a religious sense.
Mm. You mentioned your church background. Were you a Calvinist then, in terms of your theology? Was that...
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So John Calvin, of course, was one of the great leaders of the Reformation in Europe. And just as a side note, he was a key figure who got a man called Servetus, Michael Servetus, burnt at the stake in Geneva for denying the Trinity. That was his great crime. And the man, unfortunately, was horribly killed and executed for that crime of denying the Trinity. But anyway, I'm not saying you in any way associated with such outrageous terrorist acts in the past. So moving on, you went to university, I understand, where you studied religion, and that's why you acquired a lot of knowledge. But what was it? What did you discover about Jesus then that led you to change your mind about him, particularly about him being God and someone who had to die for your sins for you to be forgiven? Because I understand, coming back to this book, by the way, Apostate, which is subtitled From Christianity to Islam in Times of Secularization and Terror. And in this book, you go through many, many controversial issues that are often challenging to Muslims in the West, but also the reasons why you left Christianity, the concept of God and Christianity, Jesus, salvation and all that. So why did you come to change your views about Jesus as a Calvinist Christian?
Well, as a youngster, I think I was about 15 or 16 years old. Then, of course, you start thinking about the tradition that you are brought up in. It is a normal process. A lot of youngsters have something similar. But one of the things I always struggled with was, for example, the Trinity of God in Christianity, because we of course prayed to God the Father. That's how we call God in the tradition I was brought up in. But of course, I had a lot of Christian friends, and some of them went to other churches, and especially one friend of mine went to an evangelical church, and they prayed to Jesus. So when I was young, I thought, well, how is it possible that some Christians pray to God the Father, other pray to Jesus, and of course you have Pentecostal churches, they almost pray to the Holy Church, or they invite the Holy Church during the celebration of
the Holy Spirit.
Well, that was kind of confusing, of course, especially when you're younger and you're not, you didn't read so much about the history of Christianity. You didn't get the concept of God, of course, in an academic sense, in an academic way. So that's the first thing that was bothering me. And then, of course, there is original sin, and the idea that someone had to die for the sins of mankind, and that was the only way to salvation in this situation. And when I was younger, I once asked the minister, well, how about Abraham, for example, or Moses or Noah? Because they couldn't believe in Jesus Christ, because there was no Jesus Christ yet, because he wasn't born. So I asked him, are they in hell? No, of course not. You cannot ask such questions. It's ridiculous. Of course, Noah and Abraham and Moses are not in hell. And I said, well, how is it possible that they are in heaven then? And we have to believe in Jesus Christ as the only way to salvation. If they also got into paradise or into heaven without believing in Jesus Christ. So there was something that was bothering me as a youngster again. And when I was getting a little bit older, of course, I was, like I said, a believing Christian, and I practiced Christianity in a way most of the Christians in the denomination I was brought up in do. But the things I was worried about, I left it, and I thought, well, okay, I am a Christian. I just don't get the whole picture. And a Catholic priest I once talked to said to me, well, in the end, the Trinity is a mystery. And I thought, well, okay, then that's the final answer, because I don't get it. The whole idea of a mystery is that you do not get it. So I think that's it. And that's how the first, when I look back at my personal process, there was those days were the first days that I start doubting the fundamentals of Christianity, and especially in the denomination I was brought up in. And later on, of course, the first day I went to college, and like you said, I studied comparative religion at the Free University in Amsterdam. But the first day I started going to college was September 11, 2001.
So you started college on the very day that the Twin Towers were being attacked in New York. That's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, and of course, I already had kind of a negative image of Islam because of the tradition. And it's not like the ministers told us, well, hate Muslims or dislike Islam or something. But I was very much interested in religion in general, and especially my own tradition, Christianity. So I started reading about what did the great names taught us, and what did they say, and what did they wrote about other traditions, especially Islam, because there was kind of a competition, of course, when you look at the history of Europe. And then I read a lot of books, for example, of Martin Luther, And he wasn't too fond of Muslims and Islam. Eh? He talked about the Turks, and he meant the Muslims. And it was all negative. So the way I started studying was already in a kind of a negative way, to the perception of Islam. And then, of course, 9/11 happened, and it confirmed the negative ideas I already had. And then, of course, in the Netherlands, there was this famous filmmaker, Theo van Gogh, Theo van Gogh, and he was murdered near my old house in Amsterdam. So I thought, well, those, and the guy who did that called himself a jihadi. So I thought, okay, they really are crazy, and I have to protect the Netherlands. So when I finished university, I thought, well, what can I do? And I start teaching. But in the end, I thought, well, that's not enough. I have to do something more to protect our fatherland, so to say, and perhaps Europe or the West. And I thought, what can I do? And of course, the thing you can do when you want to change something in the most effective way is try to change the law. And then I thought, well, I have to do that, and then I have to go into politics, of course. And the most extreme anti-Islamic party was, of course, the Freedom Party of Geert Wilders. And, a part of the family wasn't too happy about that, because they said, well, he's an atheist. Why would you go work for an atheist? He has a secular agenda. He's very liberal on certain topics.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, but I said, well, that can be true. But in the end, the biggest threat to our country is Islam. So I don't care about the other points. He's the most anti-Islamic figure in the Dutch politics. So I will join his party. And that's what I did.
So, and you became incredibly successful in your endeavors. You became, not only did you join the party, you became an MP, and you became a senior figure in that party. But what kind of legal changes that you mentioned did you try and bring about then in Holland? Well, what was your agenda legally?
Well, we tried to ban Islam altogether from the Netherlands and Freedom Party, because a lot of people say, well,
I've got to stop you there. Sorry. Freedom Party wants to ban religion. It doesn't make any sense. How can you be for freedom and liberal values and then ban religion? Sorry, it just struck me as completely contradictory what you just said.
Yeah, that's true. But in those days, and that's the thing that the people who are still in the party still believe, they said, well, freedom is everything but Islam. So Islam is the only threat, because a lot of people think it's a nationalistic party or a racist party, but that, and perhaps there are some aspects that are racist or especially nationalistic or national orientated, but the whole idea of the Freedom Party, it was founded only to fight Islam. Geert Wilders told that many times. Yeah,
that's why it was founded. Good God. Okay.
Yeah. And he said, well, it was in 2004 he started the party, because Turkey was about to start negotiating for EU membership. And he was in the other party, the Liberal Party, the party that's the biggest party in the Netherlands right now, the same as the Prime Minister. And he said, well, this party of mine, the VVD, the Liberal Party, is saying that they want to negotiate. And he said, well, we cannot negotiate with Turkey because it's an Islamic country, and Islam is no part of the European history, and it should never be any part of the Europe of the future. So he said, well, we have to do something about it. But of course, in the party itself, there wasn't enough support for him. So he said, well, okay, then I'll start my own party. And that's what he did. And one of the famous figures also in the United States was a member of parliament as well in the Netherlands, is Ayaan Hirsi Ali.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she was a friend of Geert Wilders back in those days. So they empowered each other, so to say.
Wow.
Again, like you said, it's kind of a strange concept if you say we are the party for freedom, and at the same time we want to take away a lot of freedoms from
it's the practice of faith in peace in a mature country. It's extraordinary. So can you explain what in your mind would happen? Okay, you ban Islam in Netherlands. Would you then deport? You know, I'm sorry to go on about this, but it just reminds me of certain events that happened in Central Europe just 50 years before that, in Germany and Holland. And were a group, another religiously identified group who were not wanted, were rounded up, yeah. and things happened to them. What on earth did Geert Wilders imagine would happen to all these Muslims? Would they be rounded up and put in concentration camps as well? I mean, seriously, well, what would have happened?
No, he didn't say he wanted to put people in concentration camps. And he just said, I don't want any new Muslims in the Netherlands. That was step one. And he said, we have to make sure that remigration, as they call it in the Netherlands, go back to own countries, the concept of going back. There was something he wanted to pay for. So he said, well, I make it legal so people can go back. And at the same time, nobody is allowed to come in from any Islamic countries. And there was a point of discussion in the party because, for example, in Indonesia or other Islamic countries, there are also Christians. So some people in the party said, well, what happens to, for example, Christian refugees from certain countries, or Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, or Iran? I said, well, they cannot come in either. So nobody from any Islamic country was allowed to enter the Netherlands for asylum.
Interesting. So,
pretty strong point.
Yeah, it's a policy picked up perhaps by Donald Trump some years later that was challenged in the courts, perhaps.
Concept.
Yeah, but just an interesting point here is a mistake I've often made in the past. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Geert Wilders is not a fascist. He's not a far-right racist, I think. What you seem to be saying, he's like a fundamentalist liberal, like a liberal on steroids, a liberal who is just hardcore, so hardcore that he will stamp out anything that doesn't conform to his own understanding of liberalism. Is that right? It's kind of an absolutist liberalism. What is he? What kind of political creature is he? Or was he?
it's kind of a strange story because when the party started, it was still... they had the idea, there were two other more ideological figures in the party, they later on left, but they wanted to establish some kind of a Republican Party in the United States, in the Netherlands, but the old Republican Party. So a very government, low taxes, fighting crime, etc., etc. The normal conservative or right-wing policy that a lot of other parties in all over the world have. In about, I think, 5 or 6 years after they started the party, they said, well, we have 9 seats in parliament, and if you want to grow, we have to change something. And then there was another figure in the party who said, well, what we have to do, we have to start being left on social issues, like security, stuff like that. And the liberal agenda when it comes to abortion and homosexuality.
Human rights and stuff, yeah.
The things that in the Netherlands are generally accepted.
Yeah.
And he said, but we have to stay very right-wing on topics like immigration or fighting crime and stuff like that. So that's what they did. They made a combination between left and right-wing politics.
Interesting.
So the party started changing. So Geert Wilders, what is he? Is he a very right? Of course, he's a right-wing person when it comes to Islam. He's extreme. When it comes to certain social issues in the Netherlands, he's pretty left. Pretty progressive. So it's a hybrid concept in
politics. Interesting. Although that's really helpful to clarify. I didn't realize that was the evolution of his beliefs in response to the political realities then. Just moving on, so you entered parliament, you tried to promote these laws. I don't think any of the laws got passed, did they? They were never actually became the law in Holland?
No. Thank God. they didn't get enough support.
Okay, well that's some good news. Now later on, then, just fast forwarding a little bit, and you decided to write a book, and this might have been after your career in Parliament came to an end, and you then decided to, I think, write a book. Basically distilling all your fierce critical ideas about Islam and Muhammad into a written book for whatever use you're going to make of that. And then what happened then? Because your plan didn't go quite to plan, did it? Something went something happened. And what happened to the book? Because I don't have the book. We got this book, which is not the book you wrote, is it? I don't think.
No. Well, a part of it is still in the book, but when I started writing, I was still in Parliament. Ah. I left the Freedom Party because of an issue about Moroccan people. Because Geert Wilders, like we just talked about, he is very anti-Islam. That's nothing new. At a certain moment, he started changing policies. And one of the things he was started changing was that he only was talking about Moroccan people. Oh. And one thing he said during an election rally was that he said, well, we have to make sure that there are less Moroccans in the Netherlands. And he asked a crowd, it was during a rally, and asked the crowd, do you want more or less Moroccans in the Netherlands? And everybody in the rally started screaming, less, less, less. And he said, well, I'll make sure that will happen. So that was, like you said, about the 30s in Europe. That was for the first time that I, even me, got a feeling of, okay, this is kind of crazy now.
He crossed a line in targeting a specific ethnic group now, not just a faith, but a particular group of people.
But because before, I always, in my head, of course, I didn't like Islam, but it was a concept. And of course, you cannot...
religious objection,
But... For most of the people there was, okay, there's the concept, we don't like Islam, we want Islam out, and everything that has to do with Islam has to go as well. But it wasn't like I hated Moroccan people. To hate Moroccan people. As a matter of fact, there were even people with, for example, Turkish and Moroccan background working for the Freedom Party as well. Of course, they were very secular atheists. But so I thought to myself, it's kind of strange, like a betrayal almost of those people. So I said, well, and I got into a discussion with Geert Wilders, and in the end I said, well, then I'll leave the party, and that's what I did. But I still didn't like Islam, and I still wasn't too fond of Muslims because of Islam, of course. So I thought to myself, well, I finally have the time and the space, in a political sense, to write, to fulfill a long-held desire. And there was writing an anti-Islam book so that I could give a theoretical grounding for all the things I said in Parliament and why I think that Islam was a threat to Europe and why the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, was a threat in my eyes back then for the whole world. And that's what I did. But because you are in Parliament, of course, you don't have too much time to write. So in 2017, I left Parliament, and then I had a little bit more time, and I started writing and writing and reading and writing. And but at a certain moment, because I started, of course, like I said, with a very negative starting point was very negative. But I was reading so much. There was... almost at odds with the things I thought I knew, that I got into like an internal discussion with myself. So, if I want to write an honest book, I have to put the information that I found, and that wasn't too negative when it came to Islam, in the book as well. But of course, that's not what I want. I want to write an anti-Islam book. So what I did was I started writing to several authorities on the subject of Islam.
Who did you contact?
Well, several people in the Netherlands, Christian people, ministers, even a priest. I even wrote with a rabbi from a Jewish tradition because of the Old Testament, and our denomination was also a little bit focused on the Old Testament as well, not only the New Testament. But I also started writing to for example, Abdulhakim Murad from Cambridge University, Professor Tim Winter. And I thought, well, he will never answer me because I put a little Wikipedia link in the end of my mail to him. So I think, well, then he knows who I am, because it's kind of strange that a right-wing politician from another country who hates Islam start writing with a Muslim professor in the UK. So I thought to myself, well, you will never answer. And I put a lot of questions in the mail, and it took a couple of weeks. But in the end, he answered me. He sent me a very extensive email. helped a lot, and he clarified a lot of things. And he said to me, well, reread all your old books again. And he gave me some tips and suggestions for other books. He got me some names. He got me some titles. He answered certain questions himself. And he said, well, reread your old books. Then you can see where they take off and where they take the wrong turn, or where they leave certain information out, or where they add information that's not true and not part of Islamic history. So that's what I did. And it took me almost 2 years altogether. But then in the end, I had so much information that was not... it was new, almost new to me. And there was information from the Islamic tradition itself, because people ask me, how is it possible? You study comparative religion. How is it possible that you didn't know that before? But when you go to university, and I didn't study Arabic, for example, or Quran or whatever, I just studied comparative religion. So in general, you study the concept of religion. And you see, of course, I knew about Shahada. I knew about who was Muhammad, when did he live, a certain part of history. But it's not too deep, and it's not in an existential way that you look at Islam. There was no potential alternative for my own religion.
Right.
Because I was writing my anti-Islam book, I had to compare it with Christianity, of course, because that was my own tradition. But when I was comparing it, then the old questions where we just talked about popped up again, about the Trinity, about original sin, about the atonement, that Jesus Christ had to die for the sins of men. And then I read the Islamic answers, because it's an old tradition to write to each other, the polemic in history between Christians and Muslims is very old. And then I saw the Islamic answers to my Christian questions, and I thought, well, that makes sense. That's very logical. So that's where it started changing me, especially the first part was because I read a book from Fakhr al-Din al-Razi.
Oh, yeah.
About Tawheed, and he explained it in such a clear way that I thought, yeah, it's almost impossible not to agree. But of course, when I looked at my own tradition, I didn't agree, because I had to believe in the Trinity.
But I happen to know that because I read most of this. By the way, I do recommend this book, particularly for the way you look at all these questions about the classical arguments of God, concept of God in Christianity, concept of God in Islam, Muhammad, messenger in a biblical sense. And then you go on to the controversial matters. You know, does Islam legitimize and promote violence and terrorism? And it talks about all sorts of things. But it's a fascinating read. But on the very point you just mentioned, that even in the Gospels, in Mark, and you quote this, Jesus asked, what is the greatest commandment? And he himself repeats the Shema, that's here, that's the first word in Hebrew. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one, or one Lord. And as you point out in the book, and this is in the context of your discussions with Professor Timothy Winter at Cambridge, Jesus there never mentions a Trinity. And if Jesus was there in his mission, his preaching mission, to introduce people to Christian truth, shall we say, how come he never mentions it at this key point when he's talking about the concept of God? And he endorses the Shema, and that directly connects with Tawheed in Islam, particularly Surah 112, as you know, which actually uses the word Ahad, or Ahad, the one, which is the same word in Hebrew. It seems to be affirming the Shema, the Quran, I mean. And that, of course, is over against any later innovations in Trinitarian theology. But anyway, so I just noticed that connection.
That's what I found out, of course. And because when you put off your, so to say, my Reformed Protestant glasses, yeah, you start rereading your own tradition and you start reading about Islam. To me, of course, because I already was a theist, so to say, it was not the question, does God exist? The question was, which book leads me to God? What is the true religion, so to say? So that was for me, it's a starting point of my own journey towards Islam.
Just a quote here from Professor Abdul Hakim Arad, who's written a foreword to this book, along with Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, the Californian Islamic scholar. And Abdul Hakim writes about yourself, to admit that one has been wrong is seldom easy, but to write in careful and detail about one's error and then to document one's painful road to the truth reveals considerable strength of character and restores one's confidence in human nature and in the prospects for change. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing to say, and I must say it's absolutely accurate, that it's rare indeed for a man to have the courage not only to change his mind on fundamental matters of faith, to admit one's error, and then actually write a book about it as well.
Honored that Abdul Hakim wrote such a beautiful foreword, just like Sheikh Hamza. And it is, I think, a little bit too much honor, but I was it was very very nice. And in a sense, it is true, of course, that I had to admit that I made a horrible mistake, and that's what it is. And I took it to the next level by, of course, joining a political party and do all the things that I did. And I'm only glad that I had the opportunity to change my mind.
Yeah, and just a slight digression here, and this is kind of me reflecting on this, because you wrote this book, you changed your mind, and it immediately struck me, another person, this person, Robert Spencer, and an American writer, The Truth About Muhammad, founder of the world's most intolerant religion. Now, he allegedly investigated the sources. He came to a very different conclusion from you. Now, why is that? Now, part of the answer lies in another book just published by Chaim Kol, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. Now, why is this book significant? And I do recommend this book very highly. I don't recommend this book, folks, but I'm asking why Joram managed to make that connection, and Robert Spencer, who's written an awful lot of tripe, I mean, an awful lot of stuff on Islam, did not make that. And I think there is a reason, and the reason is given by Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, and I'll tell you in a minute the reason why Hamza Yusuf thinks, and I think is the correct reason. Just coming back to this book a second, who is Chaim Kol? Chaim Kol is professor of history at the University of Michigan in the United States, one of the world's leading experts on the history of Islam. He's not a Muslim. And this book has just been published, as I say, do recommend it. And he advances a very detailed scholarly case that not only was Muhammad a prophet of peace, but as Fred Donner also says on the back of this book, and he's probably the world's leading expert at the University of Chicago on Islamic history, he says, Chaim Kol's Muhammad makes a convincing case for Muhammad as an apostle of tolerance and peace. So here we have some of the world's leading academics in the West endorsing or affirming precisely what you, Jerome, have said recently. So what is it then about people like Robert Spencer? Why aren't they getting it? Well, one of the reasons is, and I'll just read what Sheikh Hamza Yusuf says in the back of your book. He says this: Joram's sincerity, and I think this is the key word, enabled him to shift his perspective, to remove the blind spot and look at something objectively, and to really try and understand it on its own terms. This led to an extraordinary search, the result of which is the book that you are now reading. The book tells the story of an uncommon trajectory, the journey of a man from animosity to charity, from despair to hope, and from belligerence to peace. Those are the words of Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, who also has written the foreword along with Tim Winter to this book. And I think that really is it, that you, Hamza Yusuf gets it right here, is that your sincerity enabled you to shift your view, enabling you to really look at something objectively and try and understand it on its own terms. And you've just said that in effect about 5 minutes ago. Other people, him, have not been able to do that. They remain trapped in the paradigm of hostility and hatred towards Islam. But the good news is excellent recent scholarship is also endorsed. Non-Muslim Western scholarship is endorsing precisely what you have done from America. So that would be my observation.
Yeah, but it's true. I think that people like Robert Spencer, and I Yeah, of course, there are people like Pamela Geller, and there's a whole bunch of a lot of Americans, by the way, who really dislike Islam, and it's kind of an industry in itself.
Yes,
and Geert Wilders knows a lot of those people. A few of them I met in the Netherlands. They came here. Wilders went over there a couple of times in Texas, but also in up north and near LA. Those people are they have a certain concept, and they are it's almost dogmatic. You cannot talk to them in an open way, because this is what it is, and all people think alike. So that makes it hard to have a serious discussion when it comes to scholarly topics. And again, that's something else. All those people, including Robert Spencer, has not an academic degree on Islam studies. So that makes And that's kind of strange.
This is a real important point, actually. You have a degree. You are a teacher. You have advanced qualifications in the religions anyway, as do other Western authors, and more or less agree. But certain other people, you just mentioned one, are not experts, actually. And they operate in almost like an echo chamber with the other people who reinforce their same hardline critical views, perhaps.
And it's kind of strange, because when you look at, for example, Austria, but also in Belgium and in the Netherlands, all the people who are fiercely against Islam, and also in politics, but also people who write comments in newspapers and are seen as talking heads on television, all those people have no academic background when it comes to Islam. Geert Wilders, for example, doesn't have one. Nobody in the party has one. The spokesman on Islam right now, because they have a spokesman on the subject of Islam, he's a guy who does physiotherapy. So it doesn't make any sense to let people like that talk about issues like this, because it has such an impact on everybody in society, because it affects you whether you like it or not.
So when did you decide to say your Shahada, and how did it feel? I mean, what happened? If you can, a little human experience there, because that moment, then you became legally, officially, before God himself, you became a Muslim. So why, when did that happen, and how did it feel?
Of course, the whole journey wasn't too nice for me. because it didn't felt good in the beginning, especially because it's you're in conflict with yourself, because the things you thought you knew are not true, and especially when it came to the prophet the prophethood of Muhammad, I was taught in a theological way that he was the Antichrist. So when you have to come from the Antichrist to the prophet of God, that's a big change. So I had to take a lot of obstacles and reread, and it was almost, in the end, I have Twitter, and in my Twitter I have ayat from a surah, and it says it's not the eyes that are blind, but the heart.
Yes.
And I put it there because there was the fundamental problem with me as well, because in the end, and I was done writing my book, and I wrote down yes, his prophethood was true, yes, the concept of Tawheed in Islam is true, so I had written it down, but I still couldn't accept it. So I left Christianity aside, and I in a rational way I accepted Islam, but not in the heart. I couldn't, because my whole life was, of course, anti-Islam. All my friends, my work, my party, family, etc. And then I had to say, okay, I'm wrong, and it's almost, it felt so negative. So in the end, I put all the books aside, and I thought, well, I don't do anything with it. I leave it for what it is, and that's it. But then a lot of books fell off the shelf here. And one of the books was the Quran, and I picked it up, and it was that ayat I read. And I thought to myself, well, that's it. I my heart is closed, I think. So when I went up to bed, and it sounds kind of sparkly, but and that's not how I mean it. But I went to bed and I did like a dua or free prayer for myself. Of course, it wasn't a dua because I wasn't a Muslim yet. But I said to myself, well, I have to pray to God, whatever God it is, if it's the God of Christianity or Islam. And I said, well, lead me, give me a sign or whatever, so that I find peace in my heart. And the next day I woke up and I thought to myself, well, I'm a Muslim. And I told my wife, and she was, she said, yeah, I already knew. that's it. And from then, of course, then I had to tell the family and friends and other people. But it was...
That must have been incredibly as challenging as anything you'd ever done to tell family and friends. Because, I mean, given your identification with a certain hostility to Islam, and then you go over to the enemy, so to speak. What did they say? Were they expecting it? Did they say, yeah, we saw the signs, we saw it coming? Or did they say, we had no idea what's happening to you? I mean, how did they react? I mean,
it differed. Some friends said, okay, whatever, it's your decision. Do whatever you want, as long as we can stay watching football together, that's fine. But there were other, it was the typical male reaction. Yeah. Later on, of course, the real questions came up. For my mother, for example, she wasn't too happy. She started crying. So, of course, you leave the religion, but you also say, in a way, I think for her, like the way you brought us up wasn't the way it should be. So I think it's also maybe a little personal, but in the end, she accepted it. And she even told me, I like you more as a Muslim. You're sweeter as a Muslim than as a Christian. So no. I still don't like the fact that you're a Muslim. So that was kind of
the fruit of the fact that she likes the fruit of your conversion, if not the...
And of course, a lot of I have to tell people in the family and at work and on other places. Yeah, and some people reacted very violently, were very angry, very upset. And at that time, I wasn't in politics anymore. I worked for an Christian broadcasting organization. Okay. But I was one of the persons on the radio that was I was, so to say, the spokesman from conservative Christians in the Netherlands.
Wow.
When I told my producer, well, I have to tell you something, he said, I became Muslim. He said, well, I can't believe it. And then he said, I noticed it because you started talking differently when we had to talk on radio with certain topics and we discussed it. And she told you were a little different than before, but I couldn't say what it exactly was, etc. But then I told him, and he was really really upset. He said, well, I couldn't sleep for 2 days. And some people said, well, I don't shake your hand anymore, and you're dead to me, and stuff like that. But it's, I think, part of of course, it's like it's something that I caused it myself, because all those years, one of the questions my mother asked me, so you hate Jews now? It was one of the first things she asked me. I said, why do you think that I all of a sudden hate Jews? And then she said, well, you told me that Islam hates Jews. You say you are part of Islam now, you're a Muslim. And I said, no, I don't hate Jews, of course not. And
I just mentioned in your great book, in the ninth chapter, Hatred of Jews is page 125. You discuss, is Christianity anti-Semitic? Does Islam teach hatred of Jews? And then it talks about Muhammad and the Jews and so on. So you really discuss this in the light of objective evidence. This is what you do now. You're looking at the facts rather than coming from a position of hostility. So that's a good chapter to read, I think.
Yeah, and it was a lot, because that's one of the issues that especially anti-Islamic right-wing organizations use. And of course, anti-Semitism exists also in Muslim communities, but that's not what Islam teaches. And when you look at the behavior of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, you see a totally different narrative there. When you compare it to what you see nowadays in extreme right, extreme left, or some extreme Muslim community. So it hasn't anything to do with the message of Islam. That's ridiculous. But of course, that's something a lot of people say, especially in those anti-Islamic environments. And one of those persons was myself, of course. So that's why my mother asked me, and I reassured her, no, that's not the case. And read the book, please, and I can explain it. But I think she didn't read the book.
No.
But inshallah that she will.
I've got a list of names here, and I want to know if they're going to be next. Casey Hopkins, Tommy Robinson, Geert Wilders. Are any of these going to be next? Inshallah.
Well, seriously. Yeah, some people said to me, well, what do you think? Well, I cannot say that it will never happen, of course, because I became one.
So, exactly.
Yeah, so I really don't. It wouldn't surprise me, of course. Yeah, it surprised me, but I think if God wants it, it will happen.
And I've met Sheikh Abdul Tim Winter at Cambridge University a number of times. He has told me that you're not the only, well, hitherto far-right politician in Europe to make contact with him. There are some other people, and in Italy, for example, there's a certain person in, I'm not going to say any more, but they're very senior in politics, identified with the far right, who is in conversation with him. And you know, things happen. So, and then there's a phenomenon of submarines, of course. There's a concept that Tim Winter invented. These are people in public life. There's even one in Her Majesty's government here, which will, of course, put the wind up. Lots of Islamophobes will be really scared. But, you know, there is someone who is a Muslim, but they're not public about it at all. But they're a sincere, quietly practicing person who just prays and is a good person and has said their Shahada. But they're a submarine, so we don't see them. But it's not a sinister thing. It's just for various reasons to do with their own particular life, it would be extremely difficult for them to go public. The damage perhaps to their families or whatever would be very severe. So they feel at the moment they're going to remain undeclared. So anyway, it does happen.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So you don't know?
I don't know their name. No, Tim didn't tell me their names, and I didn't ask because it's not. It's none of my business.
And you don't know whether people in the end come out.
Oh, I see.
For example, Geert Wilders will be a Muslim.
Exactly.
You really don't know it.
In essence, you don't know. Absolutely. And even some who might call themselves Muslim might turn out to be different as well. Anyway, I'm not going to go there, but you never know. So what are your plans for the future then? I mean, you've obviously accomplished several lifetimes of work, but do you have any future plans as a Muslim intellectual and activist and raising awareness with the public?
Well, we, with some friends, started an organization. It's called Islam Experience Center.
Right.
And, what we do, with the help from other friends, we were able to buy a lot of virtual reality glasses. Mm-hmm. And we made a movie. And what we do now is that we offer for free guest lessons in schools, from primary school to university. And what we do is that we go to the schools and that we teach youngsters, students, etc., but even teachers, what the core message of Islam is and why. And it's not so much that we say, well, you have to be a Muslim, but it's just to take away some fear, to take away some misconceptions about Islam. And it's very fun to do. So what we do, we like I said, we made a movie. And when you put on I don't know if you ever did virtual reality, but if you put on the glasses, of course, you're in a total different reality for real. So you have a headphone on. So and wow. In this video, you're sitting at home watching television. And you see all those horrible things happen, terrorist attack, you see 9/11, you hear about Van Gogh and murders, etc., jihadi, this, that, Muslim. It's very negative. And all of a sudden your television goes out and someone knocks at your door and there is a bright light. and you move towards, of course, with the glasses on, you move towards the door, and then all of a sudden you are in the year 850 in Baghdad in the House of Wisdom. And there's an old man, Salaamu Alaikum, he welcomes you, and he starts explaining about history. He shows you a map, and it's all with holograms and stuff like that. He shows you the Quran, he talks about the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. He talks about the Kaaba, what is Qibla, all the basic elements, but it's in a real fun way. And we try to rebuild, so to say, in a virtual way, of course, the House of Wisdom. So you see all those plants, you see butterflies, you see flowers. Now then, when he stopped talking, he again your vision is kind of a blurry, and then you go to another place, and then you are in Mecca, and not the Mecca of nowadays with the high buildings and McDonald's, but old school Mecca with sand, and you see palm trees and some camels, and of course you see the Kaaba. And the old man start talking, where are you? What is Mecca? Why is it important? And in the distance, you see a figure and you don't really see him, but the old man tells you that's Bilal. Who is Bilal? And then he starts explaining who is Bilal, who was Bilal first, who is he now? He's talking to those people called Sahaba, and he's explaining a lot. And then you hear a verse from the Quran, and then he takes you to the next, the final phase of the video, and it's night, and you see a very big moon, and you're in the desert, and you see all those stars, and the old man starts explaining about not about a religion and culture and the history, but he starts talking about science, and he explains about the wings from the Muslim inventions that were made, like hospitals and coffee and the camera and algebra and stuff like that. And you all see it in holograms in the sky, and you're walking through the desert. And then in the distance, you hear the azan, and it starts becoming morning. And then the next, and that's the final stage you're in. And then you're in your chair again, and you start winking, and it's like it was a dream. And then you look at your television, and it's all black, and then you awake, you can take off your glasses, and then we start talking about what have we seen, and then we start talking in kind of a dialogue, and that's what we do now, and it's very successful. We've been to I think over 50 schools already, from primary school to university. We have been to Department of Social Affairs in the Netherlands with people there. We talked to a lot of people, and everybody's very enthusiastic. So that's what we do now. We try to create awareness and take away hostility and fear.
So is this is there a website online that people could go to about this?
Yeah, it's www.islamexperience.com. And there's an intro video, and it's in English as well, and it's the subtitles are, I think, in Dutch and
perhaps that was my next question. Is it in English? Obviously, you just answered that. So, because to expand this.
Yeah, no, it's in English. And we are talking to an organization in New Zealand now, and one in the United States as well, to export the concept to New Zealand and the US.
UK, please. Hello? UK? Britain?
Yeah, of course. If there are people in the UK who want to support us and help us, and they're more than welcome. And it's a very nice. And when you look at the promo video, you can see how it is in class, because we filmed in class as well. And we give a little intro on how, why we do this, and what we want, and it's in the end. But perhaps people can look at it. It's very nice to see.
I'll put the link to that then in the description beneath below, so people can investigate that further. It sounds incredible. I like the idea of an alternative reality there, you know, or the real reality as opposed to maybe what you see on Fox News, if that's how you get your news. And on social media generally, where can people follow you? Because I believe there's a few problems with that, isn't there, following you on social media?
Yeah, there's a Facebook page. But it's fake. I'm not on Facebook. I don't have Facebook. I don't want to have Facebook. And perhaps I have to create an account now because of the fake account. Because a lot of people think that I am on Facebook, but I'm not. I'm only on Twitter.
Twitter,
yeah, that's me. But I'm not on Facebook. So everything you see on Facebook with my name, or sometimes even my photo, that's not me. But it's kind of strange, because it seems that this person is a Muslim. And then very strange, of course, because you're not allowed to lie, and you lie because you act like you're someone else, and you talk my name, but I'm not that person. So it's
obviously you've approached Facebook. I mean, are they taking steps to remove this imposter?
No, not they don't do too much, because I mentioned it 2 years ago, because that's when it started. And up till now, the page is still in the air. I've seen that they changed the photo, because they had my photo and my name and some other information about who I am, what I do, where I work. And they took that away and they changed the photo, but my name is still there. And when you scroll down, you still see my picture. So it's kind of misleading. And I think that's a bad thing.
Okay, but you're definitely, it's you, really you on Twitter. So we can look you up on Twitter. Yeah. And follow him, which I obviously I follow you as well. There's lots of interesting posts there. It's actually really worth following you on Twitter. So I do encourage people to follow you there. And I think that is a good time to... Oh, there's a quote before perhaps we draw to a conclusion. You quote a very famous Roman orator and writer from over 2,000 years ago. And this is... before you read the book itself, and use one line, and I think it's brilliant. The quote is this: they condemn what they do not understand. Exactly. I know certain individuals here in London, I'm not going to mention their names, not Muslims, of course, and they condemn what they do not understand. And this book will give you understanding about the truth about Islam. So... is there anything finally you want to share with all of us as viewers about what you've said so far?
Again, thank you very much for having me on your show. I like it very much, and I think it's very informative, like I said earlier. So please keep working on the things you do, and it's very very helpful for people like me as well. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much, and best wishes. And we'll follow you on Twitter and for your future progress. So, thank you very much for all you've done. And for, I mean, your impact on politics and in the West has been amazing for the better. And that can only your rewards in the afterlife will surely be immense, God willing. So, anyway, thank you very much. Take care.
Bye bye.
Assalamu alaikum.